I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. It started out as an ordinary duck hunting trip. Well, sort of ordinary. Vice President Dick Cheney had been invited to a secluded bayou in southern Louisiana. The Secret Service checked out the location twice and then flew in a fleet of armored SUVs to await Mr. Cheney's arrival. No one might have known or cared about this trip had the identity of one of the vice president's hunting partners not been revealed. It was Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. Here's the wrinkle. 3 weeks before the hunting trip, the Supreme Court agreed to hear a case that directly involves the vice president. Now, the rules state that any justice shall disqualify himself in any proceeding in which his impartiality might reasonably be questioned. Justice Scalia has decided that he won't recuse himself from the Cheney case. But the question remains, and our question to you this hour. Should Justice Scalia sit in judgment of the vice president if Cheney is also his duck hunting partner? Or is it naive to think that the judicial and executive branches don't mix socially and that they can't maintain impartiality when it comes to official business? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. In this hour, we'll speak with two experts in legal ethics who have differing views on this. We want to start, though, with Congressman Henry Waxman. He's a Democrat from California and the ranking member on the Government Reform Committee. Congressman Waxman, thanks for joining us.
Pleased to be with you.
You have written a letter to the Chief Justice, Mr. Rehnquist, but you're not asking him to review the decision of Scalia. You're not, in fact, asking Justice Scalia to recuse himself from the case.
That's correct. What we've asked of the Chief Justice is to consider whether the Supreme Court should develop a formal procedure for reviewing recusal decisions of Supreme Court justices. Justice Scalia is following a different standard than lower courts have used in deciding recusal questions. Let me give you a clear example of that. In 1995, there was a case that grew out of the Whitewater investigation, and the Eighth Circuit Court reassigned a case against the case was against then Governor of Arkansas Jim Guy Tucker, and the court took it away from a judge based on possible public perception of bias. Ken Starr requested the reassignment because Judge Henry Woods had a friendship with President and Mrs. Clinton. Now, they weren't even parties to the case. It was Jim Guy Tucker who was a party to the case. But the Eighth Circuit said this was a high-profile case, and it would involve matters relating to the Clintons. It would create a perception of bias by Judge Woods, and they said that, that there must be a recusal. Here we have Justice Scalia with a relationship with Vice President Cheney, which could raise similar concerns about perception of impartiality. And Cheney is an actual party to the case. The issue before the court is whether Justice Cheney should disclose information about his energy task force.
All right, but you're saying in the letter, we want to make it clear in this letter that we're not questioning the impartiality or integrity of Justice Scalia. Are you saying Scalia, in fact, should be allowed to sit on the Cheney case?
I'm saying, in effect, that there's a clear contrast between what Rehnquist is saying that applies to the rule that would apply to Supreme Court justice. It seems to be different than lower courts. And if you have inconsistent standards, it, I think, leads to erosion of the public trust in the Supreme Court because the recusal decisions appear to be arbitrary and inconsistent in the Supreme Court compared to the lower court cases. So we've asked the justices to say whether there ought to be some kind of standard, and if a justice makes a recusal decision, there ought to be some review process so that perhaps Justice Scalia might be overruled, just as the judge in the case against Governor Tucker was overruled, even though he thought he had to go forward with it.
But is there either a legal or a political reason why you don't just come out and say, you know what, in this case, based on what we know, Justice Scalia should recuse himself?
I think that what we should figure out is what decision is right. Is the decision for Justice Scalia correct? Then that decision should apply to lower court justices. If the decision for the lower court justice was right, then the same decision ought to apply to Justice Scalia. And what we're asking the court to do is to set one standard for judges one standard for judges, and it shouldn't be one standard for people who are friends of the Clintons and a different standard for those who are friends of Mr. Cheney.
Now, you'll know that already two Democratic senators have raised public questions about this. You're raising questions about this with John Conyers in the letter we're discussing. Some people are going to look at this and say, you know what, this is more about politics than it is about judicial procedure. This is about still feeling the smarts of the year 2000 then.
I think that what we've raised, and we've been very careful not to raise it as a political issue, but we've raised this question without questioning the impartiality or integrity of Justice Scalia. But I do believe that consistency in recusal decisions is important. Otherwise, courts look arbitrary. And I think that the Supreme Court, since there's no appeal from a decision of a justice in the Supreme Court, unless they establish some review process, it shouldn't be so clear that just an arbitrary one to each justice, especially if it puts them in an inconsistent position of what their lower court in the federal courts may have decided on the same issue.
You haven't got an answer yet back from the Chief
Justice.
No,
I'm looking forward to it, and I hope we provoke some thinking there and not just a stonewalling of saying, well, each justice can make a decision for himself. Perhaps ultimately that may be the case, but there ought to be some clear guidelines, and there ought to be some formal process to determine whether that ought to stick.
Mr. Waxman, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Congressman
Bye-bye.
Henry Waxman of California serves as ranking member on the Government Reform Committee. Joining me this hour from a studio at Northwestern University in Chicago, Stephen Lubit. Stephen directs the program on advocacy and professionalism at Northwestern. He's been following the case very closely. Mr. Lubit, thanks for being with us.
Good to be here.
And also joining us, Robert Destro. He is law professor at Catholic University, specializing in legal ethics and comparative constitutional law. He's joining us from NPR Studios in Washington. Robert, thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Robert, let me start with you if I can, and I'm going to put the same question to both of you. So, Stephen, you can listen in and figure out your answer. I'll ask you both to be as brief as you can because it will get complicated, I fear. Can the impartiality of Justice Antonin Scalia reasonably be questioned here? That's the language in one of the rules that justices are supposed to live by. So Robert Destro, can his impartiality be reasonably questioned here?
Well, based on the facts that we have right now, I think the answer to that question is no. And one of the things that Congressman Waxman said that I thought was very interesting is that they're applying a different standard here. There is really one set of standards, and it goes to the question of wrongful or inappropriate favoritism. And nobody has alleged that he would be, favoring Dick Cheney in this case.
Stephen.
Well, Professor Destro is wrong about the standard. The standard is whether an informed observer would harbor a doubt about the impartiality of the justice, not whether there's proof of favoritism. And applying the correct standard, there isn't any question that Justice Scalia should step aside. The whole story here appears to be that at the same time that Justice Scalia was actually voting on the petition to have the case taken up by the Supreme Court, it looks like he was planning a very special and what most people would think of as an extravagant vacation with one of the litigants. And that meets anybody's definition of creating a doubt. And once there is a doubt, then the obligation of the justice is to step aside.
Go ahead, Robert.
I have to disagree. I mean, the standard that Professor Lubit is talking about is the standard in the statute that governs recusal of justices. In a case that Justice Scalia actually wrote the opinion on, which is a case called Latecky versus the United States, Justice Scalia was the one who actually wrote the stricter standard into the rule, which is, and I quote, a wrongful or inappropriate favoritism. The other justices said that a judge should be, and I'm quoting now, a judge should be disqualified only if it appears that he or she harbors an aversion, hostility, or disposition of a kind that a fair-minded person could not set aside when judging the dispute. So that's why that's the end of the quote, and that's why I disagree with Congressman Waxman, because because there is a single standard that governs both Supreme Court justices and justices across the country, including the judge in the Whitewater case.
AP.
I don't know how useful it is to listeners to talk about the cases, but the Leidecke case was involved something called the extrajudicial source rule that isn't relevant to this matter at all.
Let me ask you a question that the Associated Press has tallied up, Robert, 20 or so newspaper editorials saying that there's something wrong here. And I was reading one law professor's opinion that says, you know, when you have that many newspaper editorials raising questions about it, that meets the test of reasonable question in terms of the impartiality of Justice Scalia. Do you buy that or not?
No, I don't buy that at all. In fact, I see this case in a much different view, and that is I see this as an attack on judicial independence. The judge in the Cheney case in the district court said, and I'm going to quote it because I think it's important, he says, "The Cheney case engenders a struggle between the political branches that is historically unprecedented and that transcends both the specific information sought and the political identity of the legislative and executive branch players involved." You've got a major separation of powers case here, and we all know what the facts are. And so now the question really comes down to how is the Supreme Court going to apply the law of separation of powers to this case? And I see Congressman Waxman's attack on Justice Scalia here as a shot across the bow and politicizing the proceedings of the United States Supreme Court.
Stephen Lubin, let me ask you to be a little more precise here. Yeah. Robert is talking about separation of powers, and most of us understand what that means. But can you make the same case about raising questions about Justice Scalia, whether or not it's a vice president we're talking about, or a lobbyist, or just some wealthy businessman who he happens to have been duck hunting with? Does it matter that we're talking about a relationship between a Supreme Court justice and the vice president, or is it simply a question about the Supreme Court justice's judgment in spending personal time with someone who's going to appear before him?
Well, we're talking about the relationship between a Supreme Court justice and a litigant, and it's tremendously ironic to defend that on the ground of separation of powers, because of course the whole point is that the two men were too close, not that they were too far apart. What you have here is an extraordinary level of hospitality, let's call it, extended by a litigant to a judge in a way that almost no other person who comes before the court would have an opportunity to do. And in this particular case, at the very moment when Justice Scalia was voting on the cert petition, he was planning a vacation with someone involved in what Professor Destro recognizes as major significant litigation.
All right, Connection listeners, your chance to weigh in on this. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. What level of hospitality is then acceptable? Presence at a Christmas party? Is that acceptable? An afternoon of golf? 2 days duck hunting? What's the measure that you would use here? Or is that even relevant as you look at questions about Justice Antonin Scalia? 1-800-423-8255. That's the number to join us. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Should Justice Antonin Scalia sit in judgment of Vice President Cheney if Cheney happens to also be his duck hunting partner? Is there a difference between a social event and an ethical misdemeanor? In fact, where do you draw the line, or should we even be trying to find a line there? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. With me on the program this hour, Robert Destro, law professor at Catholic University, specializing in legal ethics, and Stephen Lubit, director of the program on advocacy and professionalism and a professor of law at Northwestern University in Chicago. We're going straight away to Nashville, Tennessee, and Kathy is joining us. Kathy, what do you think?
Well, it seems to me, it seems to me pretty clear that if you were choosing a jury and the lawyers and the judge were listening to Mr. Scalia on the stand and trying to decide whether he could be impartial in a case involving Mr. Cheney, he would not be allowed to stay on that jury. And it also seems to me that the test ought to be not whether two legal experts can parse it down and decide that, yes, he's qualified or no, he's not qualified. The test should be, is there even the appearance of impropriety here if we allow him to sit on this case? And would it enhance the judicial system at all for people to see this justice listening to this case?
Are you saying here, Kathy, that the standard of impartiality at the Supreme Court is perhaps higher than it ought to be at any other level?
It certainly seems to me that it should be when you're asking the people of the United States to accept, for example, the decision that Al Gore should not be allowed to win or have a recount in Florida. Did anyone in the country think that that wasn't a political decision?
And yeah, actually, some people did. but let's not go back to 2000. Let's stay focused.
Well, I'm just saying, if you want people to accept that decision as being the law and being acceptable and not political, you have to avoid even the appearance of impropriety.
Robert,
I accept that decision about Mr. Gore, and I think everyone else accepted it. And I just think that if you want people to accept that kind of decision, you have to be careful what your standards are.
So, Robert Destro, if Justice Scalia were one of the candidates for a jury here and had a friendship with Mr. Cheney and were asked to remove himself, is that the same standard of impartiality that we should apply to what we're looking at?
Well, if this were a jury selection process, the question would come up, have you gone duck hunting with the other person? And he'd say, yes, I went duck hunting with him. Now, I don't know that I agree with Professor Lubitz's comment that he was the one who set up the trap or that he was extending him hospitality. I don't think we know enough facts about that. But if the judge had said, you went duck hunting with him, do any of the lawyers have any objections? And the lawyers would be able to say whether they do or don't. And in this case, the lawyers are kind of strangely silent on this one. So the judge would look at Scalia and say, do you think you can be impartial? And if he said yes, then unless the lawyers were going to get in there and challenge him, the judge is not going to remove him for cause.
So if the lawyers for the Sierra Club and Judicial Watch, who are the two parties that have taken or that are in opposition to Cheney before the Supreme Court, if those lawyers were saying we would really rather see Scalia recuse himself, that would add more weight to your perspective on this?
It would raise the question to which the court would then apply the standards that I read to you earlier. It's not, as the caller said, one that's the person has got to have no connection whatsoever. That's simply impossible in cases like this. And understand, I'm not suggesting that it was a good idea for him to go out duck hunting with him. What I'm suggesting to you is that in high-profile cases, if you were to go around this town or many other towns, you would find that judges, know people who are involved in high-profile cases. And one of the reasons we pick them and vet them so carefully to be judges is that we think that they have the capability of setting their personal views aside and being impartial. Otherwise, they have no business being judges.
Stephen Lubitz, Kathy was raising the question of public trust and whether or not that's relevant in looking at this case.
It's everything when looking at this case. It's a tremendously important point, that's why it doesn't matter whether the lawyers are asking Justice Scalia to step aside. That's a tremendously sensitive matter for people who have to rely on his own judgment and are going to end up being judged by him if he decides to stay in the case. But the real issue here is that the obligation to step aside is placed on Scalia by the statute, whether the lawyers ask him to step aside or not. And that's exactly the way it should be, because particularly in this case, which involves enormous issues of public importance, the question is whether the whole country is going to have confidence in Justice Scalia's impartiality, not whether a couple of lawyers make a litigation decision about whether to ask him to step aside. And there's one other matter as well. Robert says that we don't know enough facts, but actually we have quite a few facts. One of them, which is undisputed, is that the two men rode together on a Gulfstream jet that was operating as Air Force Two. Now, I don't think Justice Scalia could insert himself on that jet without Mr. Cheney's invitation. So we know, I think, pretty reliably that the vice president provided the transportation for the justice to go down to the camp. And then there are some unanswered questions. Who set up the trip? Whose idea was it? And how did Justice Scalia get home? Cheney came home a couple of days early. Obviously, he came on Air Force Two, and Justice Scalia has been completely silent. But you have to wonder about whether they sent a plane to pick him up, and that would be a very interesting fact to find out.
Is it a gift then? Is that what we're talking about? Is this a gift? Does this fall into the category of bribe?
Well, no.
Well, how far are we going with that? I want to understand when you say that the vice president offered this man a ride on an aircraft. Does it qualify as a gift? And if it doesn't, does it matter?
I think it qualifies as a gift. Certainly, it's a perquisite that isn't ordinarily available to other people. I think it's a big deal to take a ride on Air Force Two.
Do we know that he offered Justice Scalia a ride? As I recall reading the news accounts, this trip was set up by some other people.
No, you need to keep reading. The latest information in the New York Times and the Los Angeles Times is that the two men, and I think Justice Scalia's daughter, arrived together on a Gulfstream jet, an Air Force Gulfstream jet, that operates as Air Force Two. Now, you have to infer that Cheney offered the ride, but it's hard to figure out how Scalia and his daughter got on the plane otherwise.
Let's go back to our callers. We're at 1-800-423-8255, Amherst, New York. John's calling in. Hi, John. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Dick. Always a pleasure. I think this is funny. I call from the right. You always let me on. It's very nice of you, and I do want to thank you for it. But, you know, Scalia himself has shown a propensity to recuse himself in certain situations. Most recently with this thing with the I think it's coming up with the insertion of God in the Pledge of Allegiance and stuff like that. He was vocal about it was a very silly kind of proposal and things like that. But one thing about, I want to just digress for just a second and just talk about this juror thing. The thing with jurors is that jurors can always be replaced. You're not going to replace a Supreme Court judge. And in a cynical person may even say that, you know, the left's trying to get a cheap vote here because if I'm not mistaken, if you got a 4-4 tie, ties win for the judgment, which means that it would go against Cheney and have to do all the disclosure and things like that. So a cynical person would necessarily think that. And if I might just one more point.
Do you think this is about Scalia or do you think this is about Cheney, John?
Well, I think it's about politics, to be quite honest. I don't think it's about either one. You know, to say it, you can't have Supreme Court people in a vacuum. The left seems to want the people to live in a vacuum, and quite frankly, these people have got to be counted on in order to, you know, have life experiences and dwell upon them in order to make certain legal interpretations.
So even the idea that the recusals could be reviewed by the Chief Justice, you think it's good enough that any member of the Supreme Court is well enough placed to say, I can make this judgment?
Well, he is on the Supreme Court, Dick, because he has, at least in the in terms of the person who appointed him in this particular case, George Bush Senior. Mm-hmm. Yes, you took him because you thought he would be objective. And one more point, and then I'll just get off. It's always funny to me as a person who is a conservative to look who is always filing charges about someone being corruptible. When all I see is, and I'm just going to mention one, Bill Clinton and L'Oreal selling technology to China. I don't think there was any question he was corrupted by it. But, see, we're not corrupted by it. We just look at it, and the thing is we can be impartial.
I want to bring Stephen a little bit in here on the question of whether or not a Supreme Court justice should have anybody in any position to review a decision like that, which is what Congressman Waxman was saying at the beginning. I mean, once Justice Scalia has said, you know what, I think I'm okay with this, that's the end of it. That's what the law says right now. Is that good enough?
That's not what the law says right now. That's what the Supreme Court has decided to do, but there actually isn't any.
I didn't think there was any mechanism for review of a.
No, there's no mechanism.
That's what I meant.
Yeah, there's no mechanism for review, but I think there should be a mechanism for review. And no matter what the caller says, I don't see this as a right-left or a liberal-conservative issue. The question is, every other judge in the United States has his or her judgment reviewed on matters of impartiality. And there's just no reason to apply a different approach to Supreme Court justices. This is something that ought to be considered by the full court And then they will either defer or accept or not accept the individual justice's decision on it. But it certainly makes sense to say that people are very bad at judging their own impartiality, and they're even worse at judging the appearance of impartiality. The justices overrule each other or vote against each other on every other conceivable issue, and there's just no reason to carve this out as a as an individual decision.
Robert Destro, there's lots we don't know about this. One of the things we don't know is whether or not Justice Scalia came to this decision all on his own, or whether or not he canvassed his fellow judges on the Supreme Court and said, these are the facts, this is my role, should I recuse myself? Because we know that that's happened in the past. Would that make a difference in this case?
I think it certainly would. I mean, recently, actually it was back in June, I believe, June or July, Justice Stevens gave a very interesting talk at, I believe it was at the Chicago Bar Association, about just such case. And it opened up the window, pulled the curtain back, if you will, behind on the deliberations of the court. He was a little concerned because the president of the University of Michigan, Lee Bollinger, the then president of Michigan, who was a defendant in the big affirmative action case last spring, had been his former law clerk. And those are very close personal relationships that are developed over time. And he was concerned that sitting on the case might expose him to exactly the kinds of questions we're talking about here. And he raised it with the court, and he discussed it. They discussed it among themselves, and they all decided, well, no. You know, even though you've known him, even though you've stayed in touch with him, even though you talk to him all the time, you know, we think
case
actually did involve, you know, facts about, you know, how much can you trust the administrators at a university. This case doesn't involve any of that. It involves the question of what constitutional obligation does the president have to turn over documents.
1-800-423-8255. Next to Quincy, Massachusetts. Mark's with us. Mark, go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
Seems to me that we already assume a great deal of impartiality of these justices, because the greatest gift, far greater than a duck hunting trip, that is given to each one of these men and women is they're appointed to the bench for life by respective presidents who may or may not have to bring cases in front of them during the course of their careers. For instance, should two more justices recuse themselves because they were appointed by President Bush's father?
So what you're saying is that
the strictest standard possible, wouldn't the appointment to the bench of a justice preclude him from presiding over any case that president would bring before him in the future? If you want to bring this to the strictest possible point.
Right. Okay, Mark, thanks for that. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Stephen Lubitt, you first on that. I mean, I think Mark's got a good point that there is a general acceptance that the appointment to the bench, while it may be a favor, is certainly one that we pass over when looking at the impartiality of anybody on that bench.
Yeah, that's sort of an all or nothing argument, and it's, the caller is saying that since we can't prevent absolutely every single conceivable form of partiality, then we might as well not prevent any of it. But I think that's a non sequitur. Every justice is appointed by somebody, and obviously presidential administrations are going to be involved in litigation, so there's a rule of necessity that operates there. But there's certainly nothing necessary about vacationing with litigants in mid-lawsuit. There's just a huge gulf between those two situations.
Robert Destro, is there any place where you would draw the line? I mentioned a couple of moments ago on the program that, you know, you could be invited to a Christmas party. Scalia used that as an example to say, look, this is sort of the same as that. They could be golfing partners. They could go off on holidays together. Is there any point at which you would say, that's where a Supreme Court justice really has gone too far in developing a relationship with a litigant before the court?
Well, let me just say something first, and that is that I don't draw a distinction between Supreme Court justices and other justices, and I really don't think the law does either. The case law doesn't support that proposition. But I'll tell you where I would draw the line. I would draw the line if the judge had done anything actually inappropriate, like talking about the case, talking about the facts, discussing the law with them. I mean, you know, there's no allegations here that they discussed anything relevant to the case. If all they did on that Gulfstream jet was talk about the upcoming Super Bowl game or, you know, what's happening with the grandkids, you know, who cares?
But nobody will ever know the answer to that. I mean, if you're saying that a Supreme Court judge should meet the same test as any other judge, if I was charged with fraud and dragged up before a court, I knew who my judge was going to be, and I took him golfing the Sunday before the trial began, then the prosecutor, I would imagine, would have every right to stand up on Monday morning and say, we can't have this judge sitting in judgment of Mr. Gordon. The two are golfing buddies, and people would see that as reasonable. I'm not sure where I'm missing the connection between that and the case we're discussing.
Because this case really doesn't involve Dick Cheney as Dick Cheney. This case involves the office of the office of the vice president and the obligations that Congress can impose on the executive branch to disclose documents. This is a lot more like the Nixon tapes case in that regard than it is like, you know, the fraud case you just described. These are questions of constitutional law, and it really doesn't make any difference if it was the janitor who was the named party in the case.
Stephen Lubin, we have just a couple of minutes before we have to take a break, but do you see this as about the office of the vice president or about the man in that office?
Well, it's about both. Certainly, Mr. Cheney's credibility and prestige are on the line in this case. His own lawyers in the lower court said that it might conceivably lead to a contempt citation if the court sought to enforce the disclosure order. So I think Cheney obviously has a significant personal stake in this, just as President Nixon had in the tapes case. Actually, I think it's a very apt analogy, and I think people would have been shocked if in the middle of the Nixon tapes case, the president had taken one of the justices on vacation.
1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Connection listeners, is it naive to think that the judicial and executive branches don't mix socially? What kind of social mixing is acceptable when one member of the executive branch is in a case before the Supreme Court? 1-800-423-TALK. To join us, I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. With me on the program today, Robert Destro, law professor at Catholic University, and Stephen Lubin, director of the program on advocacy and professionalism at Northwestern University. We're talking about the controversy over Justice Antonin Scalia and Vice President Dick Cheney, whether or not, in fact, Justice Antonin Scalia should recuse himself from a Supreme Court case that involves Mr. Cheney, given the fact that just last month the two men were duck hunting partners together in Louisiana. 1-800-423-8255. Next to Chapel Hill, North Carolina, Nick's on the line. Nick, thanks for calling.
Hi.
What do you think?
The question I have is that this case is about Mr. Cheney having various confidants in the energy business consult with him, and he wants to keep the list of the names of these people secret.
You mean the case that's come before the Supreme Court
the case,
is about
the case
that?
Actually,
yeah.
Coming. Now, the guy who gave the party in the duck blind is a confidant of Cheney's and is in the energy business. Is there any possibility that he's one of the people on that list? And does this change the whole nature of this? Is he kind of like a possibility of being in an unidentified party to this case in a certain sort of way?
His name is Wallace Carline. He's head of a company called Diamond Services Corporation and probably worth... Yeah, very much part of the oil and gas drilling industry, and there were four or five other people who were a part of that trip at the same time. It makes the question a little bit broader, Robert Destro, to bring in issues that might be related to the very case that is before the Supreme Court. Is this a part of the equation that we should look at or not?
Well, I don't. I mean, in some cases, maybe, but I don't think in this one. I mean, I think that the question here is really the pure question: can Congress compel the executive to turn over these kinds of documents, no matter whose name's in them? And I think one of the reasons that a lot of people would dearly like to have Justice Scalia off this case is that because of all the members of the Supreme Court, he's probably got the strongest and sharpest views on the absolute separation of the branches.
Well, hang on a second.
He said so in many cases.
Let's go back to what Nick's asking, because Nick is asking whether – I mean, I would assume that the Supreme Court is going to take a look at the Cheney case and take a look at the list of people who met with Cheney and make a judgment about whether or not that list should be public or not. And if one of the names on the list is the same person who was taking everybody duck hunting, including one of the members making the decision, doesn't that automatically make it part of the equation?
I don't think so. And the reason is because you've got this statute involved called the Federal Advisory Committee Act. And the question is whether or not the statute applies, which the lower court said yes. And if so, whether or not you can compel the president to turn over these documents. And I don't think that has anything to do with who's on the list.
Stephen, what do you think?
Actually, I agree. I think the question before the court is the narrow question is the applicability of the FACA to the situation. It would, on the other hand, just be breathtaking if it turned out Mr. Carlisle had met with the task force and one of the people whose names is being withheld. No one has suggested that. I don't suggest that. There's no reason to believe it. And I really don't think that's part of the issue here.
1-800-423-8255. Next to Brookline, Massachusetts. Jay's with us. Jay, thanks for calling.
Thank you, Dick. I'd like to step back a minute and just reflect on what appears to be the demise of ethics in the United States. I recognize that I'm an old dog, but when years ago when I was a young man, my father was the sole investment department of a major insurance company, and I remember his telling the major brokers he did business with that if they sent him Christmas presents, he would cease doing business with their brokerage. And when I was a purchasing agent in a public agency, I did not permit any of my suppliers to give Christmas presents. Now, this kind of separation seems to be totally out of fashion, particularly among your legal eagles who are parsing how many devils can dance on the head of a pin.
Are you saying, Jay, that the Supreme Court justices, if we bring this back to the case we're talking about here, ought to have absolutely nothing at all to do with the members of the executive branch while they're sitting on the bench? Is that where we need to start in your mind?
Well, I think timing is everything. I mean, look at the timing in this case. I mean, it is not in the abstract. Justice Scalia was not partying with the vice president in the abstract. This wasn't an inaugural ball. This was several days after agreeing to hear a case of major importance, and one could certainly see that there was no crying necessity to go to Louisiana to shoot ducks at this particular moment in time. And if he just had to have the smell of gunpowder, he could have done it on his own. We're not looking back and saying that they sat at a table at the awarding of a honorarium to someone. I mean, this is timing, and a gentleman in that position should have better judgment. It should not even cross his mind if the ethics of the past were even present in people's minds.
I think Jay makes a really good case, Robert, and Stephen referred to it earlier in the program, that the Supreme Court agreed to review the Cheney case in the middle of December. And it was after that decision that the two men chose to go duck hunting together. Now, even if you take away whoever invited whoever on whichever plane or armored SUV, I mean, under the circumstances, don't you think that that might have been the time for Justice Scalia to say, you know, Dick, for the next little while, let's not hunt together because you're before my court?
Yeah, that's not an unreasonable suggestion. I have to say, you know, I might do that if it were me, but he didn't do that. And now the question is whether or not we really are going to, you're going to recuse a justice whose vote is needed to get a definitive ruling on this case, you know, without any apparent concern from the parties that he's not going to be able to do justice. And I agree with Stephen that the test is really for the judge. The judge has got to make a reasonable decision about whether or not he or she thinks that they can deal with this impartially. And Scalia made that judgment. We might question his judgment with respect to taking that trip, but I don't think anybody, including Congressman Waxman, has said they're going to question his judgment on the bench. That's a very different case.
And Stephen, if I understand where it is right now, there's really nowhere for it to go because Chief Justice Rehnquist has already said in answer to a couple of senators that it is quite improper, I think are the words that he uses, to raise questions about...
Ill-considered,
thank you, for them to raise that question. And so we could talk on about it till we're blue in the face, but in many ways it's over, isn't it?
Well, it's over unless Justice Scalia changes his mind, and I think that's really tremendously damaging to the court for the very reasons that the caller pointed out. There's almost no other profession where that sort of intimacy would be allowed in the middle of a crucial decision. Just to give you the most immediate example, neither Robert nor I could grade a student while simultaneously accepting a trip to New Orleans on a private jet from the very same student, no matter how much we would say, well, I could be fair in the grading, the other students wouldn't believe it, and rightly so. Looking at your profession, Dick, you couldn't review a book of an author who was simultaneously providing you with a trip on his private jet. Those are standards that apply to everybody in society across the board, wherever the appearance of impartiality makes a difference. And perhaps Justice Scalia's vote is needed. I think the idea that there's a conspiracy among leftists to get him off the case is just silly. I mean, nobody but Scalia decided to take the hunting trip. But that's really just a shame if a justice takes acts that truly disqualify him. I do have to point out that there was once thought to be a doctrine called the duty to sit, which meant that Supreme Court justices, by God, needed to stay in the case if at all possible. And that was actually abolished by Congress by statute. And Justice Rehnquist himself has acknowledged that there is no duty to sit in his opinion in an earlier case called Lilleberg.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Next call from Hopkinton, Massachusetts. Connie's with us. Connie, thanks for calling.
Hi. I want to flip this. I would think the Republican Party and Cheney would be sitting back and going, if we get a favorable ruling with the justice still part of the ruling, then we'll have public opinion against us. And I think they would want to come out and say, you know what, why don't you step down? And because right now, if they get a favorable ruling, they lose. They can't win it.
But aren't they damned if they do or damned if they don't,
exactly,
Connie? Because if they said something publicly about encouraging Justice Scalia to recuse himself, then everybody would jump all over that, say, see, that's proof. I mean, they're really almost in many ways obliged to button their lip on this one, aren't they?
Maybe they need to do it behind the scenes, because right now they're damned if they do, damned if they don't, if he doesn't recuse himself.
And
this is going to weigh out in the public court, and the Republicans in an election year can only lose.
Robert Destro, in many ways, Connie, thanks for that call. It brings us to the question of public trust and how people regard the court. And I'm thinking of some of the issues that have been raised this hour and wondering if, you know, the justices themselves aren't sitting around in chambers saying, what can we do to make sure that the standards of impartiality that we present to the nation are beyond question, and the facts of the case lead me to think that conversation's not taking place. What do you think?
Well, I think actually quite to the contrary. I think that the speech that Justice Stevens gave, which was really quite unique. I mean, we don't often get a window on the court's internal deliberations. You know, but I think that the court, you know, there's a whole series of cases in which, if you looked at a series of cases in which the justices recused themselves, one caller mentioned that earlier, but if you were to look across the range of the justices, I think they recused themselves on a regular basis, and that the rules for doing so are pretty arcane. And most members of the public neither know about them, you know, nor have a particular interest in getting involved in the specifics of them. But what the caller does raise is I think a very important question. It's a question of public trust. And what I think, and this is why I come back to the question of judicial independence, what you've got here is Congressman Waxman and the other and some senators raising a question about impartiality, but they haven't brought forth anything that would indicate that in a real case, if this were really brought in a motion before the court by one of the parties, that they would agree with them. And in the end, what you find out is if the court hangs 4-4, Waxman wins. I mean, that seems to me that he's just as he's got a political reason for wanting to do this, and I think it's detrimental to the court.
But whatever the political motivation, Stephen, we still come back, do we not, to the initial point about whether or not his impartiality might, by a reasonable person, be questioned, right?
That's the whole question. That's the standard under the statute. That's the standard under the Code of Judicial Conduct that's been adopted by every court in the country except the United States Supreme Court. And I think it's the standard that people have a right to rely upon. And I think it's a standard that Justice Scalia is at the very least misapplying. And I think that's a shame.
Does this go away then, or do you think that this hangs with the court, Stephen?
Well, there are serious reforms that could take place here that would be very important. And again, I don't think it's anything approaching a right-left issue. I think liberals, conservatives, Republicans, and Democrats could really agree upon this in the future. The full court ought to vote on recusals. They should not leave it to an individual judge. Congress could pass a statute to that effect. The court itself could adopt a code of conduct. As I said, it's the only court in the country that hasn't publicly adopted a code of conduct, and I think they could do that. And that, of course, would make things much clearer for the public. And finally, they could actually take the step of announcing their own votes on certiorari, something that they don't do regularly under the current practice.
Robert Destro, will we agree that maybe this is an opportunity for reform, if nothing else?
No, I wholeheartedly agree with exactly what Stephen said. The court, there needs to be more scrutiny of the court, both internally and externally. And I think that the American public oftentimes gives them a lot more credit than the institution really deserves.
I want to thank you both for being with me on the program today. Robert Destro, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Robert is a law professor at Catholic University in Washington. Stephen Lubitz, good to hear from you.
Thank you.
Stephen directs the program on advocacy and professionalism at Northwestern University. Earlier in the program, we heard from Congressman Waxman. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.